Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has reconvened. The Honorable Chief Justice in that case will declare precise. Your silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Except for, as I mentioned previously, Justice Kroski, who may remain standing because of a back issue. So, calling this morning, James Cobb versus Gary King, 20 AP 925. Appearances, please. Good morning. All right, the lineup is 25 minutes, followed by 30 and 5 in rebuttal. Please proceed.
May it please the court. This is a case, as the court's well aware, about an easement, and specifically whether an easement runs with the land. To answer that question, the court addresses two issues. The first issue is whether the instrument itself creating the easement communicated an intent that the easement runs with the land. And if the instrument communicated no such intent, the second question is whether Section 706.10 subpart 3 of the Wisconsin statutes compels that conclusion anyway.
Counsel, do we have to overturn Borak to rule in your favor?
Let me give you a lawyerly answer of maybe.
Tell me how we don't have to. I figured your answer would be yes, so help me out with that.
I think if the court decides that the appropriate analysis is to examine the instrument first, discern an intent, and stop the inquiry there, if the instrument is clear, you don't need to overturn Borak. But in order to be intellectually honest about things, I think you do need to overturn Borak, because Borak says the law implies this easement runs with the land regardless of whether or not it's so expressed in the instrument. In other words, Borak says you have to negate that conclusion in order to negate the idea that the easement runs with the land.
Is your position fully consistent with Justice Abrahamson's dissent in Borak?
Advances many of the arguments that Justice Abrahamson advanced, but not all of them. Our position advances additional reasons that the dissent did not discuss. The statute itself is where I'll begin, but before I do that, let me just go through a quick scorecard, because the personalities can get a little confusing. Reardon's conveyed an easement to Hessels. Reardon's eventually sold their property to Cobbs, my clients, and Hessels eventually sold their property to King, Mr. Stein's client, later, after the Cobbs acquired their interest. I'm going to begin with 706 sub 10 subpart 3, because I expect as of those two questions, this is the most important one to the court. There are a number of reasons that that statute does not dictate the conclusion the Borak court attributed to it. The first reason that I'll list off is one that Justice Abrahamson's dissent did not address. And that is, if you look at the 706 sub 10 in its entirety in context, what you see is subpart 5. Subpart 5 of that statute, interestingly, has a passage which I'll read in part that says, quote, a conveyance by which the grantor warrants the land or its title shall be construed except as the terms of the conveyance may otherwise provide, to include covenants for the benefit of the grantee, the grantee's heirs, successors, and assigns. And then it goes on to describe specifically the covenants that transfer by operation of law unless that idea is negated in the instrument. This is exactly the idea that Horak found in subpart 3 of the statute, just two paragraphs above it. Yet you don't find any of that language in subpart 3. It's completely absent. So the question at the forefront is, why would the legislature incorporate expressly an idea in subpart 5 that it failed, neglected, or deliberately didn't select in subpart 3? The second point is a point that Justice Abramson's dissent addressed directly and quite well, and that is that this statute has two components to it, the first clause and the second clause. The first clause reads, in conveyances of land, words of inheritance shall not be necessary to create a fee. In conveyances of land, words of inheritance shall not be necessary to create a fee. Well, the dissent pointed out quite correctly that an easement is not a conveyance of land. It is the conveyance of an interest in land. And the dissent also pointed out in something that the Borak majority never expressly addressed, that this clause only applies for conveying fees. Well, as many cases hold, including the Polubitsky case, which we quoted in the brief, but I'll repeat here, quote, an easement is something quite different from a fee or a limited fee. In one case, title does not pass, but only a right to use or privilege in the land of another. In the other case, the title does pass, even though the use be limited. So a fee is not an easement, and an easement is not a fee. The dissent correctly asked the question, well, how can this first clause possibly apply to easements under those circumstances? And answer that Borak never expressly provided.
Counsel, it seems to me a lot of your argument would give, if we gave credence to it, would, instead of saying this was an easement, we would say it was a license.
It's a license?
A license, which is another type of an interest that is sometimes conveyed. How do you think this easement differs from a license?
That's a good question, one that I don't have a clear answer to because I don't think the law provides a clear answer. The best I can say is an easement is more permanent than a license, but an easement is not permanent unless granted in perpetuity.
But there's no case that says what you're saying.
Pardon?
There is no case that I could find or that you referenced that said an easement is not permanent unless granted in perpetuity.
Well, that's one of the ways of communicating the grantor's intent.
I don't disagree with that, but that's different than saying it's necessary.
I don't say that an easement is never permanent unless the grantor spells it out explicitly. I say an easement is sometimes permanent, and Borak is a good example. In Borak, the court addressed four or five terms in that easement that suggested it lasted forever. For example, it was called one easement, but it granted two rights. One of those rights was granted to successors and assigns. It was an easement expressly for the purpose of cranberry production, granted flowage rights and sand removal rights. You need both for cranberry production.
This was granted expressly for vehicle traffic.
I'm sorry?
This was granted expressly for vehicular traffic.
For vehicular traffic, exactly. Mm-hmm. But that the important part of the easement there is it was granted to the Hessels and no one else.
Well, that's what your argument is. I guess my concern is that I could agree with everything you say, but I would call it a license. And my concern is stepping it into an easement, which is another form. And certainly since 2010, when Borick came out, you don't need these words of inheritance anymore to make an easement continue on.
You're concerned with Mr. Stein's point that lawyers have relied on the court's ruling in Borick. I don't know what kind of empirical proof there is for that, but I can tell you that the lawyer practicing 42 years, we don't respond to change very quickly.
And, that's a fair comment.
I would be surprised if there were lawyers drafting easements today who said, I don't need these words that have been used for centuries. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question, Justice?
Yes, to some degree. Thank you.
So, Polubitsky confirms that this isn't an easement. This isn't a statute that applies to easement, at least as the court has defined that term over the years. The second clause doesn't declare it's an easement, that it applies to easements either. That clause says every conveyance shall pass all the estate or interest of the grantor unless a different intent shall appear expressly or by necessary implication in the terms of the conveyance. What that means is that Mr. King got what the Hessels owned. When they passed their fee to him, he received fee interest in that property. But it doesn't answer the question of whether or not this easement is transferable, because the Hessels got what the Reardons gave them and could convey no more than that to Mr. King. So if the Hessels received an easement that was transferable, Mr. King got it. But if the Hessels didn't receive an easement that Mr. King didn't receive a transferable easement, Mr. King didn't get it. This statute doesn't create rights. It just simply confirms that they are conveyed unless the grantor expresses otherwise. And
also,
the Reardons,
according to what's been presented to us, the predecessors of the Cobbs took their property with notice that there was an easement over the property. It was recorded, and in, 1978, that's when we started, in 1981 in a land contract, there was a transfer showing that there was still an easement over the property. 1987, again, the easement was shown on the deed. So I'm surprised that now the Cobbs are complaining, well, they're not getting along with their neighbors, which is how we always end up in court on these things. But it seems to me they had notice, not only by the public record, but by the documents from their predecessors, that the easement was there on their property.
There's no denying that, but what did they have notice of? Did they have notice that this was a transferable easement, or did they have notice that this easement was personal to the Hessels? The Cobbs acquired their property when the Hessels still owned the adjoining land. And consequently, to say, well, you had notice of an easement, that's true. But whether you had notice of an easement that would eventually go to Mr. King, that's not so true.
Well, when the Cobbs took the property, they had that on their document. They knew there was an easement there.
They knew there was an easement that may lapse when the Hessels' interest in their property lapsed, or it may go on for perpetuity. It depended what the easement said. And the easement said here, as I just indicated a few moments ago, that it belonged to the Hessels and no one else.
Well, that's not what the easement says. If it said that, we wouldn't be here.
If it said, and no one else, I agree we wouldn't be here.
Right.
But the question is, does the law require it say, and no one else? Our position is that certainly that's not a requirement that's found in 70610 subpart 3. It's not even required by 706 sub 10 subpart 5 because it's implied. The overriding point is that why is this implied when it appears nowhere in 706.10, which talks about construction? As a matter of fact, there's another section of 706.10 that also informs this court's decision, and that's subpart 6. And subpart 6 says, except as provided in sub 7, doesn't apply here, and except as otherwise provided by law, no warranty or covenant shall be implied in any conveyance, whether or not such conveyance contains special warranties or covenants. So that statute says, if you want to imply a covenant that runs with the land, you can't, unless the law implies it. This is not a point that was made in the dissent either. So what Borak did is exactly what subpart 6 forbids. And there's more, because the statute of frauds, which is found at 706.02, specifically 1C, requires that a covenant that runs with the land be expressed in writing.
Well, this was expressed in writing.
Pardon?
This was expressed in writing. I don't think you have to say it according to the case law that follows the statute of frauds that's we're expressing this in writing, and the writing speaks for itself.
Well, the easement's expressed in writing,
right.
But the covenant in the easement's not, and this is what the statute of frauds says
okay,
about
I understand
that.
What you're saying. Now, I misunderstood.
Right. The statute says you not only have to identify the parties and the land, you have to identify the interests conveyed and any material term, condition, reservation, exception upon which the interest is to arise, continue, or be extinguished. So if you want a covenant that runs with the land, the statute of frauds requires you put it in. And that is really where Borak went wrong. Borak is, and this is going to sound a little harsh, but I'm the appellant.
You have license, right? Justice Rosenthal? Yeah, license. There you go.
Borak presents an excellent example of what the court accomplishes or fails to accomplish when it violates what I regard as one of the central tenets, one of the most important decisions this court ever issued, State Ex Rel Kalal, K-A-L-A-L, if I've mispronounced that. That's.
I think it's Kalal.
Thank you.
He helps us with that.
I'm just trying to be consistent, Russ. I help my friends to my right all the time. Ralph Kalal.
Kalal. Thank you.
No problem.
That decision says when you encounter a clear statute, as this court well knows, you apply it and you stop. Borak said at paragraph 22, this statute, on cursory review, I think is their words, is clear. And it's clear and it contradicts what we're about to do. Well, applying that central tenet of construction, Borak should have stopped, but it didn't. The court then proceeded to do just what Colel says they can't, they shouldn't do. It explored legislative history. It looked to other states. It looked to other statutes. It looked to the state of New York. And it did everything except look at the reason this statute was enacted. This statute was enacted to change the common law. Our forebears in England created a rule that said if you didn't use words of inheritance, you created a life estate. Words of inheritance were absolutely necessary to pass a fee interest in property. Dewey Keene recites that in the context of a will case. That's so when you read the statute in that context, it makes complete sense. That's why it talks about fees and conveying the entire interest. But instead, the Borak court went on and it said, well, we think that because New York would create a different rule, our statute can't mean what it says, so we're going to follow that lead. Colel has a great line. It says that it is the enacted law, not the unenacted intent, that binds the public. People read statutes, not legislative history, not New York cases, not New York decisions. And that's why courts faced with a clear statute like Colel was faced stop and apply it. It makes no sense to apply this statute to easements because the common law rule never applied to easements. It was not necessary to use the words of inheritance to create an easement.
Does it matter at all if this easement is appurtenant to the land versus specific to a person? And do the parties dispute the circuit court's finding that the easement was appurtenant?
The easement is appurtenant. It's a weak presumption that no party has determined is conclusive here. As a matter of fact, because there is no evidence supporting a different construction, that presumption cannot carry the day. That principle is found in Paulson Lumber, 91 Wissecond, 692, specifically at page 699, quoting Wigmore, where they say essentially, this court says, a party cannot, the opponent whose case is a denial of the other party's affirmation has no burden of persuading a jury. Until the burden of producing evidence has shifted, the opponent has no call to bring forward any evidence. And then it goes on to say, a presumption doesn't shift that burden. The statute of frauds is inconsistent with that presumption. If you have to have an express statement as to material conditions by which the interest continues, supplying it by presumption contradicts the statute of frauds. So, too, it contradicts 706, subpart 10, subpart 6, which says courts don't imply covenants into conveyances. So the short answer to your question, Your Honor, is yes, the presumption is pertinent, but it's not helpful here. And the circuit court found it was of minimal relevance, and I think Mr. Stein's briefing notes pretty much the same thing. I guess the last point I'd simply make is this, that the fact that words of inheritance may be unnecessary in another circumstance doesn't make them unimportant. Words that traditionally connote that an interest in property is transferable are important because their absence shows just the opposite, that it's likely not transferable. What Borak found is in a logic that's difficult to follow, is that the absence of words of inheritance, something that traditionally shows assignability, proves the interest is assignable. Unless the court has any questions, that concludes my remarks.
The timing. It just went off anyway.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Josiah Stein, and I represent Gary A. King in this matter.
You're going to have to reposition the microphone because your voice is quite soft. You can raise the counter a little bit for you. That might help. See how that goes.
Is that better?
Oh, it's much better.
Very
much
good.
Better.
Thank you
very much.
The application of Borak and by extension Wisconsin Statute 70610 subpart 3 to the facts of this case is in harmony with well-established Wisconsin law pertaining to appurtenant easements. Because this is an easement case, the court will indulge me. What I'd like to first do is discuss the terms of the easement and look at the easement document that's involved here. Second, I would like to briefly address the well-established Wisconsin law pertaining to appurtenant easements, again, how that applies to this case. And third, with that foundation, we'll address Borak and the statute that's at issue in this case. As a starting point, this is a easement document. This is the only factual issue in this case. I move for summary judgment. I believe the procedures for summary judgment were appropriate in this matter. The issue is defining this easement and whether or not it provides my client with access to a roadway over the neighboring parcel. There's some significant indicators in this document related to the fact that it's appurtenant and the fact that it is tied to the property. First, it's titled a roadway easement. It's not merely a license. It's not merely a temporary easement, a personal right. That's further strengthened when, while I understand that the grantor and the grantees were individually, that's not where it ends. They describe that the Hessel's interest in the easement is to the following described property, and they go on and provide the legal description. And that legal description is, when it starts there, the part of Lot 6, that is now my client's property. So this I believe, is significant as well in that it provides this key, that this is not a mere personal right, this is tied to the land. It describes the purpose of the easement. It's vehicular, it's ingress and egress. Words of conveyance are used. They talk about grant, convey, give over, and allow. I believe that the only reasonable interpretation of this easement is as an appurtenant easement, which I believe is significant, and I heard Burnett concede that this is best construed as an appurtenant easement. Why is that important? Well, Wisconsin case law has held that easements, appurtenant easements, are tied to the land, and I rely on the Gomerick decision on that. Wisconsin courts have long held that appurtenant easement ties the rights and obligations of the servitude to ownership or occupancy of the land itself and is thus transferred with the land. A personal right or an easement in gross is never presumed unless, it's never presumed when the easement deed can be fairly construed as appurtenant. And that's longstanding, well-established Wisconsin case law. That's from an 1874 case, Spensley v. Valentine. And it talks about how the importance in the presumptions in this case. And by the way, there was some discussion about how the presumptions in this case may or may not have been met. The presumption is gathered by interpreting the easement document itself. That's the starting and end point. There's no additional facts or evidence.
Is there any way under Wisconsin law, as you read it, that an appurtenant easement could be terminated?
Well, certainly it can be in very difficult circumstances abandoned, or certainly the individual that owns the appurtenant easement terminate it. Yes. An appurtenant easement can be temporary if the document addresses that these.
But this easement is silent as far as the term of the easement.
It is.
So is it your argument then that under Wisconsin law it goes in perpetuity?
It is, yes. And that's also based on the Lutrop decision, which I believe is helpful in this case. That is the 1925 Supreme Court decision. And in that case, it talks about how the courts are inclined against forfeiture of these types of easements unless such intent plainly appears on the easement deed. So the idea here, as I read Wisconsin law, and that we haven't even gotten to Borak yet, as I read Wisconsin law as it relates to appurtenant easements, that you can create a limited right, you can create a temporary easement. It happens. You have an easement for a period of 10 years. There's an easement while there's a house on the property. There are cases like that. But that's not the presumption. The courts are inclined against forfeiting appurtenant easements unless there's express language in the document.
When I read this easement, though, it does say that the undersigned, and there's three people, Reardon's, Galing's, grant, convey, give over, and allow to Herbert Hessel and Gene Hessel. Do you think a layperson who reads this easement would think that somebody other than the Hessels or somebody succeeding the Hessels would be entitled to this easement?
Yeah, that's
a tough question.
It is a tough question because, in my experience, lay people come to my office to tell me, what does this deed mean? But in reviewing that, I think it's significant that the property is identified. We'd be dealing with a far different issue if the dominant estate, the property that the Hessels owned at that time and my clients now own, wasn't mentioned in that easement document.
But wouldn't it have to be mentioned so that the parties know what they're talking about? I mean, they know between themselves, but this is something that's going to be recorded. So, of course, as a matter of course, the legal description of the property would be identified, wouldn't it?
I don't believe so, because if this was a mere personal right, it would be, in my mind, an easement in gross. It's a personal right to the individuals where they have a personal right to travel over this corridor if it's silent, while they're alive. And so if an easement in gross is created, which is the other kind of easement other than an appurtenant easement, that would denote a personal right that would provide an interest personally to Herbert and Gene Hessel. So in that instance, when you're recording the legal description that would be necessary to record with the Register of Deeds, the necessary portion would be the easement corridor. That's described as the southerly 16 feet of the neighboring property.
Could you respond to your friend on the other side's argument about 70602 sub 1 sub C, that if this were a condition of the easement, that it extends to subsequent purchasers that it would have to be in writing, that that would have to be spelled out, if I'm understanding the argument.
Right, right. The statute of frauds argument.
Yes.
Frankly, I'm not certain how the statute of frauds would apply to this. All I can say is we have a writing. We have the longstanding law related to how appurtenant easements are defined. And then, of course, we have 706.10 sub 3, which is the construction statute that Borak addresses.
Is it your position that an appurtenant easement is a fee?
No. An easement's not a fee. I believe the law is clear on that.
So that part of Borak is wrong?
No, I don't believe Borak held that an easement is a fee. In fact, I think that was clear that it didn't take it that far. What Borak did was read the statute, and I understand some of the concerns that have been raised with the decision and the looking at the review of the legislative history and all of that prior to its decision. But I think it's important to look at the statute because, as I read it, it's a single sentence. It's a short statute. It is the first statement that deals with those fee interests, where it says, in conveyances of land, words of inheritance shall not be necessary to create or convey a fee. The statute doesn't stop there. It's separated by a comma, and it continues. And so I believe that's significant, that the statute doesn't end with saying that that this is only dealing with the fee interest. And we know that because as you review the statute further, it then goes on to describe every conveyance shall pass all the estate or interest. Now, we know interests are not fee interests. We know that, I believe that's conceded in the briefs from both parties, but for further definition, I believe Wisconsin Statute 840.01, which is a definition portion of the statutes, will define interests in real estate and include easements in that definition. So the statute deals with more than simply fee interest. It goes on to then talk about interests, which is easements. And so continuing to read that statute, and the key, I believe, the key word to consider, what is meant by the all? Because that's a... That's a key distinguisher as to how this easement's interpreted. As Mr. Burnett suggests, that simply means, the word all simply means that the grantor gives what they own at the time that they're making that conveyance. But you don't need a rule of construction statute to say that. That just happens. If you own property, and I own, for instance, a half interest in a home as a tenant in common, and I convey my interest to a third party, I convey that half interest because that's what I own. You don't need a rule of construction statute to say that. I believe that word all should be read with the guidance of the first clause because it pertains to it, and it should be read broadly enough to suggest that that means the full title, I believe, is the term Borak used, but it should be read sufficiently broad enough to include and encompass the transferability of that right.
Mr. Stein, even if we think Borak was not correct, why should we rule in your favor?
If you think that Borak was not
correct? Even if we think it's not correct, what reasons would you give me for to not overrule Borak and rule in your favor?
So,
did you understand the question?
Yeah, I don't understand.
Okay, I'm saying let's assume Borak was wrongly decided. Okay. Why should we still uphold it?
Sure. Stare decisis, yes. And that is ultimately what Mr. Burnett is asking for. I don't believe that it's equivocal at all. If the remedy that they're seeking is pursued, there's no other conclusion that Borak would have to be overruled. That's just an unmistakable conclusion. Overturning existing law should not be done lightly. It requires special justification. The very purpose of stare decisis is not necessarily to maintain perfectly decided decisions. If that was the case, there would be no need for stare decisis. The concept of stare decisis stands for this proposition that there needs to be a consistent predictability with the rule of law. It provides a basis that society can govern its affairs. And this is significant because this is a real estate and how to interpret real estate deeds and how to interpret the words that are utilized in those deeds. So to change that law at this point would potentially upset the basket cart, so to speak.
So in response to that, if I understand Mr. Burnett's argument, I believe he said that lawyers are slow to change.
Yeah.
And so I think what you're talking about perhaps is the substantial reliance. And
yeah.
Can you please respond to what Mr. Burnett said, which I took to mean like people haven't, it's only been 10 years. And perhaps in real estate law, because there is such a long history, 10 years is just a little blip.
Sure. And we don't have any evidence here today as to what may or may not have happened, but this is not a insignificant law. As I pull the statute book off of my bookshelf in my office and review this statute, I will see Borak cited there, and it will clue me in as a real estate lawyer that this is the statute that applies to that. We simply don't know in the last 11 years how many lawyers have relied on this, but not just lawyers. What about title companies and assessing the appropriateness of the easement documents? What if they're providing title insurance on the basis of a deed utilizing the rationale of Borak, and in reviewing a deed, understanding that there are no words of inheritance, and we have a Supreme Court case directly on point, we can insure title. There's many potential issues that that are present here, and the court has been reluctant to overturn cases, particularly in issues of property or contract.
You know, there's a picture that was provided to us by opposing counsel of the property owned by your party, and it is on a lake?
Yes.
Yeah, and then the Cobb property behind it is on what, St. Bernadette Road?
That's correct.
Okay. There was a claim made that the property would be landlocked without the easement, and a counter-argument that, no, it's not landlocked. It has access by another road. As I look at the picture, I can't tell that. Can you explain that to me, please?
Right, and I'll readily acknowledge the record's not very clear on that at all, and I could explain why, but the basis of our claim that the property would be landlocked is really based off of an affidavit filed by my client in a motion for summary judgment. My client will be landlocked without this easement. Mm-hmm. I don't know how far I want to deviate from the record.
No, I don't want you to go outside the record.
Okay.
If there's nothing else, I just thought, because I have the picture, which is part of the record, and I can't see how your client's property would get to another roadway from the picture, it just may be that the picture isn't.
I'm not aware of any other legal or practical access.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Thank you. That's a fair answer.
Counsel, during your argument, you advanced that the analysis in part begins and ends with the wording of what you have in your wording. I think it's in your affidavit, isn't it? That was attached, at any rate, to Mr. Burnett's brief. The affidavit sets forth on Appendix 28 of Mr. Burnett's brief the document that we are dealing with. Yet, it appears as though the Reardons, when they were conveying their property to the Cobbs, which is the next couple of documents, did convey the land contract and did convey the deed with the words subject to the easement. What import, if any, do those documents have in your argument? You advance that we need only look at one document. So I had a hard time reading the small print, and so I want to know if my efforts were in vain.
I think they're important in the sense that it provided the comms with notice of this easement, and there weren't any uncertainties related to the fact that there was an easement related to their property transaction. Even so, to the core principles of easement law, as I understand it, once the easement is created, and if it's appurtenant and it's tied to the land, it runs with the land regardless of whether there is an express mention of the conveyance or not. So I don't believe it's a critical of critical import, but it is of import to note that that was something that the Cobbs were aware of, particularly if it gets to the point where I view the easement document as unambiguous. I think it's clear, and it clearly describes an appurtenant easement tied to a piece of real estate. But if there is some question related to that, well, then those types of issues may become of more importance. Yes, the Cobbs had notice of an easement as well when they purchased the property.
You say it's tied to a piece of real estate because it talks about the property that it runs between. Is that correct?
It's tied to the piece of realty because it mentions the dominant estate specifically, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Couldn't
it possibly mention, have it in there even if it isn't tied to it? In other words, if you're going to give a easement for ingress and egress, and I think this is the question that was asked earlier by my colleague, doesn't it make sense? I don't know if to have, whether it goes with the land or it doesn't go with the land, it makes sense to have it described at least. I don't know why you think that's so determinative.
Well, I believe it's determinative because it puts into context what the Hessels were getting. They were getting an easement to allow them particular ingress and egress to the property that they owned. And that I believe is significant because that indicates that we're dealing with not merely personal rights, we're dealing with property rights. And again ties into, I know I've cited this before, but it ties into the presumption of Spencer v. Valentine, where personal easements are never presumed when they can fairly be construed as engrossed, as appurtenant, rather. I'd like to take a moment as well to talk about the Lutrop decision from 1925. And I think it's significant, particularly because I want to ensure that something is clear in reading the response brief. No, sorry, I filed the response brief. In reading the reply brief, I noted that this was dismissed out of hand, and I don't believe it should be. That 1925 decision applied the predecessor statute to 706.10 sub 3 to that particular case. And I believe that perhaps the confusion in dismissing this has to do with the relatively factual background of the Lutrop decision. I did not find it straightforward at all. Reading 100-year-old cases and the factual patterns of them, you sometimes lose track of where things are going, and it takes a while to really understand what's happening. But if you'll indulge me, broadly speaking, in that case, the grantors owned all of the property. They conveyed property to a third party. They granted also to this third party an easement for ingress and egress and to the grantees, heirs, and assigns to use a easement to be developed in the future. That was a conveyance back in 1887. Within the next 13 years, that easement was actually used, it was opened, it was utilized, not just by the grantees, but by the grantors. They were using their own land. And in a subsequent conveyance in 1900, what then happened is that the grantors conveyed a parcel of property to the plaintiffs, and they indicated it was subject to an easement over the easterly 14 feet. None of the conveyances related to the grantors addressed anything related to awards of inheritance. Perhaps initially it wasn't necessary because they were the owners of the remaining land. But the whole idea in Lutrop was that, at least part of the idea as expressed in Lutrop, was that words of inheritance were never used related to the grantor's reservation of this interest. I think that's significant because what the court did in addressing that lack of words of inheritance was take that predecessor statute and simply said words of inheritance aren't necessary. And so I believe that case does require some careful inspection. I understand that the facts are somewhat different because we're dealing with a reservation of a grantor and reserving a strip of land, but it involved the same issue where you don't have anything suggesting that the grantors and their heirs and assigns have any continued right, merely reserved a right to the easement. And that is, I believe, a case worthy of consideration.
I did consider it, but it says no words of inheritance are necessary to create a fee. Yeah. You agree an easement is not a fee.
It quoted the statute. I wish it would have said it better.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
How is the easement that your clients say they hold different from a license?
A license is a mere, it's less than a personal right. I believe the case law describes and defines a license as a permission. My understanding is a license is always fully revocable. So, I hope I'm not mistaken on that, but that's my understanding of a license and the difference in this. So we have two different types of easements and then a license as well. We have an appurtenant easement that's tied to the land. An easement in gross, that's the second type of easement in Wisconsin. That is a personal easement. Those can be transferable or personal to the individual. But then a license is even less. It's a lesser right. That is a revocable permission that's given to a third party. I see the yellow light is on. I want to take a moment to just suggest that as I see this case, I believe that the court should uphold the decision made by the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals. I believe that it should reaffirm Borak that 706.10.3 plainly applies to easements. I believe Borak does complement the historical case law. Borak was a different factual circumstance in that it involved profits. And water rights and sand removal rights and things of that nature. But even so, the core holdings in Borak are directly on point as they both address easements.
Do you think that Borak's rationale is at all undermined by its reliance on New York law because the New York Supreme Court held that an easement was an estate in fee under the statute? And as you concede that an easement is not a fee,
yeah,
it seems like a lot of Bork's analysis relied on law that does not apply in Wisconsin.
Sure. Part of the analysis was based on that. Two responses. First, the Borak majority opinion found the statute sufficiently clear and then went on to describe the reasons and started with the text. And then it did further analyze the history in the New York statute. The reason I think that it's of lesser importance is because the idea that that was quoted in the statute at the time that the statute was revised, sometime in the late 1800s, to include the additional language in the easement was mirrored off of the New York statute to give the statute its full effect, and that was the legislative notes for that statute. So I believe it's fair to say that the thought process at that time would have been to incorporate the New York model to Wisconsin law.
You've invoked reliance interests as a reason to abide by the doctrine of stare decisis, but this court has also said that we do more damage to the rule of law by obstinately refusing to admit errors, thereby perpetuating injustice, than by overturning an erroneous decision. Would you respond to that?
Sure. And generally, I don't disagree with that. What I would say in this case is that the circumstances of this case would not Borak complements existing Wisconsin case law, so it's not going to cause grave harm to uphold it. I believe it would do more damage to overrule it.
What if our holding, if we agree with your position, were perspective only?
I'm sorry, I missed the last part of the question.
Well, if we disagree with you and we side with the other side, what if our holding were prospective anyway? Then it would not disturb any of the easements that were drafted in reliance on Borak's expression of the law.
That's correct. Although I do believe that this easement was drafted before Borak went into effect. But yes, I understand what you're saying. Yes. And I see my light is on.
You paused just long enough.
Is that how that works? Thank
right,
you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Superintendent?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. On the stare decisis issue, courts don't speak infallibly, and it is the rare case where the court should continue to adhere to a holding even while it admits it was erroneous. That all that does is it promotes a disrespect for the law. This case has been in existence 10 years or so, and there is not a strong reason, given the subject matter, to perpetuate it. As to Justice Rogenczak's question about whether the property's landlocked, there's a factual dispute on that subject.
Okay.
You will find the counter to the affidavit in Record Entry 56. The Borak sin is that it took a term on the statute, conveyance of land, and it substituted different words, conveyance of interest in land. And it said, because an easement is an interest in land, it's the same as conveyance of land. What that does is it just simply is an exercise in judicial substitution for words the legislature addressed. As to Justice Bradley's point, Borak ducked the fee issue. You had asked about whether or not Borak addressed that. The dissent raised it prominently. Borak ignored it entirely. At the end of the day, if you step back and look at what the court's being asked to do, you're being asked to impute words into an instrument private parties have developed. And that is something that the court has steadfastly refused to do. Courts don't impute terms into contracts or written agreements between parties. Columbia Propane, which is cited in the briefs, and many other cases hold that. There was no term in this easement, but that hardly informs the questions the court has in front of it, because an easement that's given personally expires naturally. So the fact that there's no limited term doesn't tell you one way or the other what the grantors intended. There has been no response to the
Council, I just want to ask one quick question on this. Let's assume we were dealing with a conveyance of land and you didn't have, you know, the words of inheritance. Do you think that does create any kind of presumption for the way a court should read?
The words of inheritance? I might follow.
Well, yeah, if they're, let's assume you're dealing with a conveyance of land, okay?
Sure.
And the words of inheritance aren't there. I just want to get your reading of what that statute does mean in a context of which you're dealing with a conveyance of land. Like, do you think they're...
So if there's a deed that's missing words of inheritance.
Correct. Do you think there's any... this statute implies or requires or suggests any proper way to read it?
I do, because of the first sentence.
Okay. And so just the sort of implication only applies to conveyances of lands. Is that your position?
That's what the first sentence legislature wrote says.
So other types of conveyances just simply don't if it's not a conveyance of land.
Any kind of
conveyance of an interest or easement, including conveyance of easements are pertinent.
Yeah. If it's not a conveyance of land, the first clause doesn't apply. As to the issue of pertinence, there has been no answer to either the statute of frauds or 706 subpart 10 subpart 6, which says you don't imply covenants, you may not imply covenants. And then there's nothing special or extraordinary about this easement except for the fact that it doesn't use words of inheritance when it talks about the rights the Hessels received. The fact that it describes the property that's subject to the easement is quite ordinary. I see my time is up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for interesting oral arguments and briefs in this matter. The court will reconvene in closed conference at 1 o'clock.